Welcome back to another exciting episode of the Captain America Minute, where we examine the 2011 Joe Johnston-directed feature, Captain America, the First Avenger, at the rate of 1 minute of screen time per episode. I'm one of your hosts just a few miles from Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. This is Jim O'Kane of TVDads.com.
And I'm Hal Bryan, an airplane nerd from the home of the Experimental Aircraft Association here in Oshkosh, Wisconsin.
And I'm Brian Fees, a graphic novelist and lifelong Avengers comic book reader.
And we're back in the barracks with Dr. Erskine and Steve in that very complicated minute that everybody at Lola had eaten extra bottles of Advil, just trying to figure it all out. It's a beautiful scene, simply because we didn't notice their hard work.
Right. Yeah. Another quiet scene of drama and introspection and character development that was a massive effect spectacle.
Yes.
Yeah. A masterpiece of special effects.
A masterpiece.
Even really better. Is. Kudos to those folks at Lola for getting it all so right that we didn't even notice.
Yeah, I will never get over that.
Well, Hal, why don't we go into this minute and find out what's the story here?
All right. In the dim barracks of Camp Lehigh, Dr. Abraham Erskine sits across from Steve Rogers, the bottle of Augsburg liquor resting between them. His voice carries a heavy weight as he begins, his eyes distant. So many people forget that the first country the Nazis invaded was their own. You know, after the last war, my people struggled. They felt weak. They felt small. And that Hitler comes along with the marching and the big show and the flags. Erskine leans forward, his tone darkening. And he hears of me, my work. And he finds me and he says, "You," he says, "you will make us strong." Well, I am not interested. The scene shifts to a shadowy meeting. Johann Schmidt, sharp-featured and intense, stands before Erskine. "So he sends the head of Hydra, his research division," Erskine says. "A brilliant scientist by the name of Johann Schmidt." Schmidt's image looms, a man in crisp uniform, his eyes burning with ambition. "Now, Schmidt is a member of the Inner Circle, and he is ambitious," Erskine continues. "He and Hitler share a passion for occult power and Teutonic myth." Ancient runes and artifacts flicker across the screen, Schmidt poring over them with fervor. Erskine's voice grows grim. "Hitler uses his fantasies to inspire his followers. But for Schmidt, it is not fantasy. For him, it is real. He has become convinced that there is a great power hidden in the earth, left here by
who?"
And it's a cliffhanger.
By yes. Terrible suspense.
Yes.
By some guy named Larry. Yeah,
no, I'm going to just fast forward to tomorrow's minute, because I got to know.
No peeking.
Some guy named Larry. That would be a whole different tone. It's not a tesseract. It's just a shoebox full of mementos.
So look at the Pinewood Derby. Yeah,
we were joking before we pushed record today that in this episode, Erskine's name might as well be Basil Exposition, and because he drops a load of exposition here, and he's going to continue for another into the next minute. But it's important. We need to know this stuff. We need to know the connection between Schmidt and Erskine and the Tesseract and the Super Soldier program. This is tying all those threads together for us.
Yeah, one of the important things that this particular minute plugs in is that Schmidt knows who Erskine is, and Schmidt knows what Erskine has done, because they have more than enough history, and he is probably the biggest danger to the Third Reich of being able to, if he did it once, or as far as we know, he's worked on the super soldier thing before, and he needs to be stopped. So, it's an interesting thing. Now, I don't think we have mentioned that Hugo Weaving was in The Matrix, but this is the most obvious, Agent Schmidt, Agent Smith crossover, right down to the point where we're seeing a bunch of Schmidts appearing in the background. Like, where's Keanu? What are we going to do next?
And you wonder if was there any temptation, like if you truly had a screen full of, hundreds of them, would one of them have been wearing a slightly different black suit?
Or the sunglasses.
Or the sunglasses, just as a nod. But
if he only twist his neck slightly.
Right.
Well, we went through it second by second. We looked. We didn't see any of that.
Right. Yeah. Didn't see any such thing. But there's nothing wrong with casting the right man for the job. And, you know, certainly in the form of Colonel Phillips, starring, you know, with Tommy Lee Jones as Tommy Lee Jones. You know, he's perfect. Hugo Weaving is, I can hardly picture anyone else.
Well, and it's a nice nod, but it's also an interesting filmmaking choice by Joe Johnston and his editors, I presume, to tell the story in this way. Again, it's very visual, showing, not telling. You know, Schmidt, the Nazi flag, the swastikas, the ancient runes. It's all put together in this kind of this package, this amalgam. Right. That we absorb visually, and even if you're not listening to what Erskine's saying, you get the gist of it.
Yeah, it did.
Well, and you, go ahead. I would say Brian, you called out the Herr Doctor Basil Exposition or whatever role he's playing in this. But it's not that common in this film to have a scene with this much exposition. So it's certainly a technique Joey was using very sparingly. You know, we've had so many great discussions about a scene that is so economical in its writing and its storytelling, and it's getting so much across with very little. And this one, you know, has more exposition in the grand scheme of things. I don't think it's very much compared to a lot of films, but it is interesting that this is the one time when we, you know, as you said, Joe and certainly his editors had to say, we got to take a second and give a little speech and make sure to catch everybody up.
And he's also, I mean, Hal, we've been through this before with Joe Johnston on The Rocketeer, that he picks up this Leni Riefenstahl look of the film. I mean, we had the animated film in The Rocketeer showing that Nazi commandos were going to take over Washington and turn the flag into a swastika and things. Yeah. And here we have this big waving swastika and this this looming shadow of Schmidt in pretty much sepia tone in black and white.
Right. That whole Heute Europa Morgen die Welt kind of thing.
It's interesting too. That's a great point, Jim, because we're hearing this story, this exposition from Erskine's point of view, and he's a German and he's probably seen the propaganda films. So the way he tells the story looks like a propaganda film. You know, it's interesting that it seems, and this just occurred to me, that it's flavored through the lens of Erskine.
Right.
Yeah. And I think the way we see the story.
Right. Absolutely. And I think building on that a little bit, I think the most powerful bit of dialogue in this minute is that line, you know, people forget that the first country that the Nazis invaded was their own.
I love that.
And that's absolutely spectacular. I mean, that's chilling and an excellent point. You know, we look back on history and you simplify it. Well, the Germans were the bad guys and they rose up and did this, this, and this. Well, somebody had to lead them there.
And in the putting Erskine in Augsburg, Germany, in the middle of Bavaria, that was kind of in German history, Augsburg was the home of liberal thinking and tolerance and like especially with religious tolerance during the 1500s, rights of religious minorities were recognized first in Augsburg, so Catholics and Protestants and Jews could live in the same in the same town. They even had the city council was multi-denominational, to put it that way. They were also a center of capitalism. They were a very capitalist city. I think I may be wrong, but I think that that's one of the places where the taler came from, where they would be minting silver. So it's like a center of capitalism, liberal thought, and liberty and freedom of expression and freedom of assembly, freedom of is all these things that National Socialism destroyed. Right. So the subtlety of that is beautiful. I mean, it's just one of those things that kind of pop up the more you dig into it, as we all go through Wikipedia and all the other things and go, oh, I didn't know that part. But yeah, it's understanding the concept of what Erskine lost,
right,
It's underlined.
And I don't know, Jim, I know you've been doing a lot of let's call it Hitler Googling lately, and you're concerned about your permanent record. But
yeah,
Hitler, of course, being Bavarian, I don't know how far from Augsburg he would have hailed. But that's outside of the film. That's a big, bitter slice of historical irony. I was never familiar with it, even if they're far apart, that this is happening in that same sort of provincial area of Germany, going from Augsburg in the 1500s, and then 400 years later, the great evil coming from the general area.
Yeah, and I'm not that familiar with German culture, but I've always understood Bavaria to be where, like, that's kind of like in our country, it's kind of like the heartland. It's the deep, it's the deepest part of the country. I mean, if you have a Bavarian accent, you're considered a kind of a hillbilly,
or right,
you're kind
a little
of
folksy.
You're a little folksy, and like you're gonna put on the Lederhosen and be the German that people think of when you're thinking of Germany. You're thinking of pulling out the accordion and doing, you know, playing and stuff all.
The Alpenhorn.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. You're going to be carrying at least 8 steins of beer so that, you know, you can get through October. But, it, you know, it's like it's the heart of Germany that he's coming from. And the heart of Germany in this case was, you know, such an American ideal of tolerance, freedom, and liberal thought. I do want, there is something that I think needs correcting that we do that it seems to be from about the 1970s and 80s on, we have this mythos that develops about Hitler and the occult and, you know, like the sword of Langerius and, you know, the Holy Grail and all these other things that, you know, that
the spear of destiny,
Ark of the Covenant, all this stuff. Hitler seems to be, you know, the guy that I keep thinking of him as Porkins, but the FBI Major Eaton in Raiders of the Lost Ark is saying, you know, Hitler's nuts on the subject.
One of the top men.
Yeah, and you know, he says Hitler's nuts on the subject. It's like, no, you got the wrong Nazi there. The Nazi that was nuts on the subject was Heinrich Himmler. He was fascinated by the occult, pagan mythology, Nordic runes, all the Germanic folklore, any kind of pseudo-scientific racial theories. He started a thing called the Anhabe, I think is the way you pronounce it. It's an SS research institute that sponsored expeditions to, like, the Himalayas, Iceland, Scandinavia, to prove that there's, you know, Aryan racial superiority and find lost ancient heritages. So they kind of mix archaeology with like super fringe ideas like Atlantis and the world of ice theory that, you know, that you can get through. There's a hollow earth at the North Pole, that kind of stuff. And, you know, and Himmler, who was in charge of the SS, he also had the runes and, you know, the SS, the logo, at, you know, that he had on all the shirts, that was like an S rune.
Right.
He wanted to find out about reincarnation, all this other cuckoo, you know, stuff. But
and he would have been behind the Totenkopf, the Death's Head,
all the magic stuff. And
right. Well, and part of that is you know, a deliberate choice that fascists make, which is to recall the glory days when we were strong and ruled the earth. You know, if you've been humiliated in World War I, you want to call back those earlier times when, you know, we were the best, we were number one, we were the purest race, and so those callbacks to the ancient runes and the ancient symbols and the ancient mythology is very deliberate. It's part of why these cults of personality work so well,
right? And with you know, I think with Hitler, you've got a couple of different things happening. I mean, number one, as you said, Brian. Whatever his personal beliefs might have been about Himmler's obsession with this stuff, that then, as Jim said, eventually gets sort of, you know, Hitler gets painted with that brush himself. Whatever his personal thoughts are, okay, this is useful to him for the very reasons you laid out. This kind of mythology and this obsession. There's also, I'm sure, a sense of, well, just in case he's right, you know, if there is some sort of supernatural thing we can grab onto. But I also think, you know, as Hitler descended just into the, you know, the madness of drug addiction and just the sort of the lunacy that came along with that, you can easily see that, he's going to be vacillating, but also probably open to whatever the nearest sycophant is whispering in his ear.
Yeah, and you know, Himmler wasn't the only one. Rudolf Hess was big on astrology and stuff. He was, he was constantly doing things like reading about the Holy Grail and stuff like that. Where, you know, even getting into Arthurian legends, he thought that Britain was going to be where they were going to be able to find their real power, and he was trying to convince. He was trying to convince Hitler, maybe, now, even though it's, late in the war, we should go attack, invade Britain.
Now, the difference between real life and movies like Captain America and, Indiana Jones is, in the movies, those things are real.
Yeah.
Which makes it so much more interesting.
Yeah.
So much more fun.
Right.
Come and get your face melted.
Yeah. It's like, I don't, thank God I didn't, get in touch with Archimedes or anything. So it just, we can go over the reality of there wasn't any super science involved. I mean, he did have, he had von Braun and company making, rockets and things. And then, Hal and I have talked in the past about all the different, the 163 comet and stuff. There was a lot of technology that was, if they had applied themselves and used it rather than in the middle of the military and trying to take over Europe and the world, they probably could have been, the scientific wonders that they could have hit in the 40s would have been amazing.
And of course, they also had eyes on the atomic bomb. And I think there's an interesting parallel, maybe a metaphor here between the super soldier program and the bomb.
Sure.
We've talked before about how Dr. Erskine is kind of an example of Operation Paperclip, of the United States bringing von Braun to the United States to develop our space program. Well, in this movie, the United States brought Erskine over to develop our super soldier program. One Steve Rogers, no matter how strong and mighty he is not an atomic bomb. But I think the parallel is apt.
Yeah, right. And also jumping into bed with Dr. Zola later. I mean, we're gonna come up with that in a future minute. But coming up to Dr. Zola would be really where that gets even more paperclippy as time goes by, and you start wondering about when you do that, are you skipping over the part where you might be dragging Hydra in with the bathwater?
Yes,
don't bring the multi-headed octopus in with the bathwater.
Yes.
That's what my grandmother always said.
So I still think, just as a minute, one would rather not have the exposition. I think the minute needs the exposition, and it's still just one of my favorite little interludes in the film because it's quiet, and so many modern movies are afraid of the quiet moments, and they don't understand that the quiet moments are the ones that make the exciting moments worthwhile.
Yeah, it's that, I think in comic strips, it's called the third panel.
The third panel.
You just need a reaction of just somebody, looking at each other, and then you get to the punchline. So we need this third panel.
Yeah.
And I'm still skimming through this again, looking at the work that Lola did is amazing. Oh, I just keep looking at Erskine's hand moving in front of Skinny Steve and thinking how many layers that had to happen in between the two, and how many times the camera had to be locked down and the noise that it made and all that other stuff. But we can, when you're just sitting in a dark theater watching this up on a screen, and you can completely forget that's not what Chris Evans looks like at all.
Right.
Yeah. And that Chris Evans was actually there being a full-size Chris Evans, and they had to take him out and put his face on, on Mr. Deeney.
I know we keep sort of circling back to that, but I'm not sure you can overstate how remarkable it is and how incredible it is. And I think the fact that the work that Lola did both does and does not speak for itself. It does because it doesn't. It doesn't advertise itself. It doesn't. You're not looking at it and say, no. At no point are you saying, "Oh gosh, that looks almost real."
Yeah.
You're just accepting it, and that's the highest compliment you can give. And You know, they deserve everything they get.
I was thinking it's probably not on their sizzle reel because you want to see, no, I want to see a 35-year-old Michael Douglas, and I want to see a 99, you know, 9-year-old Haley Atwell.
And a, 200-foot-tall kaiju marching through the city or, you know, whatever.
Yeah, not two guys sitting on bunk beds. You know,
who are these two guys talking? This is dull. No, but it is absolutely masterful.
It's a solid minute. Solid minute.
No, for sure. Wow. Well, there's not a lot to cover in this from a background, but I think this was, I think we were all in agreement that this is a great minute to get it. And we're going to get into even more exposition in the following minute. So stay tuned on that. But anyway, check back with us. I'd like to thank our audience for listening in. And we're always available here. If you want to continue the conversation, we're available at Camp Lehigh, the Captain America listeners base on Facebook. If you do like our show, don't forget to subscribe. Leave a like in the podcast streaming service where you found this episode. Also, please check out our website, capminute.com, for the latest about our podcast topics and guests. And be sure to join us here next time on the Captain America Minute.
I can do this all day.